Welcome, dear listeners, to the Jacobs Podcast. As you're probably aware, the podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and a range of other platforms. Please, in whatever forum you listen to the podcast on, leave a review or leave a comment or get in touch with me at seanjacobs.com.au if you'd like to discuss a topic or if you have any ideas. I'd love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy today's episode and thanks for listening. Welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Jacobs Podcast. Today we're talking identity politics with Dr. Jeremy Sammet. Dr. Sammet is a Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies and the Director of the Centre's Health Innovations Program. Well known for his strong work on Medicare, he has a PhD in Australian Political and Social History from Monash University and has published on historical topics including Australian Federation, the World War I conscription referendums, the women's suffrage movement and the white Australia policy and multiculturalism. Jeremy, welcome to the Jacobs Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sean.
No worries. And I know this is probably a bit of an odd start or an odd question to start out with, Jeremy, but something I heard the other day on a podcast was a question: if you could go back to any time in history, where would you go? And the person being interviewed was the Nobel economist Vernon Smith, and he said he would like to go back to the 1750s to hang out with David Hume and Adam Smith. I know this is an odd question, but if you go back to any time or place in human history, where would you transport yourself to?
Yeah, dude, that's a really interesting question. Look, I think I would go back to the time of World War II, and for a pretty, perhaps any idiosyncratic reason, but my reason for that would be that, fortunately, people of my generation have never had to fight in a, you know, in a mass war, but I'm also aware, you know, because I'm a historian particularly, of the horrors that a lot of people had to go through during things like World War I and World War II. And I've always sort of wondered how I would cope if I was to be put in that situation, whether I, to put it bluntly, could be able to pass that test and endure that sort of thing. And the reason I would pick World War II is because, you know, that was a war to fight what by any stretch of the imagination was a clear evil, which was Nazism. And it was the sort of war where you couldn't, you know, sort of intellectualize your way out of deciding not to fight in it by, you know, saying, you know, this is old, you know, the old men of Europe have dragged us into World War One, or, you know, we should take a peacenik approach. So I think would be a really, you know, to sort of storm the beaches at Normandy would be a real test of courage. And on the one hand, it would be worth dying for, you know, sort of things that really matter, you know, liberty and democracy. And I think if you managed to pass that test and got through it, it would put the rest of your life into, you know, perspective and sort of make you feel that everything was possible, and maybe you wouldn't sweat the small stuff as we all tend to do. So that would be my answer to that question.
Sure. And yeah, very much a sort of sink or swim time, and I think we lose touch with those past instances where the stakes were really, really high and there's a clear evil, as you say. Just out of interest, have you seen Dunkirk, the movie?
I have seen Dunkirk, the movie. I thought it was, a little bit sparse. I thought that I sort of expected. I've sort of been brought up on sort of epic World War II, you know, versions of the Normandy landing, The Longest Day, and you know, movies like that. And I thought that the scale of that was slightly disappointing. I didn't think it really evoked really what it would have been like, but then again, how would I know? So, but yeah, I guess, you know, we all sort of, I saw the other day, it was 20 years since Saving Private Ryan was released, and I think that was, that caught the graphicness of that, and that's probably something that's influenced, you know, my thinking of, you know, what would happen to me if I was caught in that, how would I react if I was in that situation? So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. It was very interesting, and I know myself, one of the, if I, you know, to ask myself this question, I'd like to go back to, I think 1788 would be very interesting around Sydney, there in Sydney Harbour. I think it's just one of those things where we can take for granted how very little there actually was there. You know, we think about a Sydney Harbour Bridge or, you know, the Opera House, and just sort of take for granted that it wasn't always there. It was only a couple of hundred years before, but I think that would really test me out personally, is especially in that sort of sink or swim type theme. But just to move on, Jeremy, one of the things I've noticed about your writing specifically is that you've actually come back to identity politics. And I knew you, and I think a lot of other people out there who read a lot of your great work, as somebody who's a bit of a Medicare or health guru, but you actually go back to your pieces from 2005 and 2011, and some of the titles there are The Long Demise of the White Australia Policy and Why Women Really Got the Vote. And you've actually returned to writing on issues of Australian history and identity. Did you ever think that you'd come back to writing about these issues? And why do you think, I think it wasn't, you make the point that it wasn't called identity politics back then, but why are we seeing this emerge now, and why are you writing about it now, do you think, Jeremy?
Sure. Well, it's true. For the last 11 years, I've, you know, worked as a think tanker at the CIS and been, you know, dealing with public policy issues, health mainly, but also I've written a lot about child protection. I've written a book about child protection policy and adoption in Australia. And I've also, through that, branched out into doing Indigenous affairs. Look, when I started writing, when I did my PhD, that was in the 1990s, what was happening at the time was what we then called, rather than identity politics, we called it the national identity debate. And part of that was this, what underpinned a lot of the sort of policies and approach of particularly the Keating Labor government, was this idea that Australia was, and always had been and still was, a racist society. And a lot of the work that I was doing, and this particularly became relevant, particularly when the Tampa crisis and the refugee boat people issue was being played out in the early 2000s. I was trying to write, particularly that essay on Quadrant about the demise of the White Australia. I was trying to say that we should point to the strengths of Australian society, which is actually the way we've managed to overcome our racist past in unrecognisable ways compared to the situation, say, in 1901 or with the White Australia policy, or you know, up until the mid-60s when the White Australia policy was abolished. I think the reason, as you say, the reason I've returned to this is that this sort of work has gained a new importance in the age of identity politics. And for me, one of the key turning points for me to realise that these issues mattered again, and they mattered to not just a debate about racism, but to these broader issues of identity politics, was really the reaction to Julia Gillard's misogyny speech a few years ago, where, you know, for all intents and purposes, that was just a political diversion and an attack on the man. But it got this huge reaction across social media, and it was shared all these times and talked about and discussed. And that really, to me, was the start and a signal that this identity politics was a real social phenomenon that we need to take seriously. And as I've started to do more work, and then I've also realised that what's really at stake here is that this identity politics is a threat to some of our fundamental freedoms. We've seen that over the Section 18C debate, what happened to the students at University of Queensland, QUT, what we've also seen with the Bill Leak case, what we've also seen with the Andrew Bolt case. And not only are some of our fundamental freedoms of expression and thought at stake in this debate, I think it's also the fact that identity politics threatens to make us a far more divided community by not doing what liberal democratic societies have done traditionally, which is find ways to enable us to live together peacefully despite our differences. Identity politics tries to eradicate those differences, and rather than do what liberal democratic societies do, which is to respect the rights of all citizens. And that's really where I think identity politics, that's the level at which identity politics needs to be addressed. And that actually is what I'm now doing. We've just launched a new program at the CIS, which I'm heading up, called the Culture, Prosperity and Civil Society Program. And that is to ensure that the CIS is able to engage in these key cultural battles of our time and provide the sound and sensible leadership that's needed on these issues, which often is very hard for people to speak out on because of the politically correct times we live in.
Sure, and I think it's a very worthwhile initiative, and it's good to see that you know, programs like that are getting some traction, not just at the CIS, but elsewhere as well. Do you think, Jeremy, at the same time, while we've seen this ascendance, you know, you've had the return to writing about identity politics, we've seen that reemerge, but just in terms of the actual national identity debate, that seems to have sort of potted on as well. And I think you can probably see some more brushstrokes of that in this, that sort of continual, I guess, push for a republic, you know, the ascendance of China. A lot of international strategists or writers in Australia talking about the less reliance we can have on the United States and Britain. And then as we become more of an Asianized or very, you know, like a Chinese or Asian-oriented society, we've got to pivot ourselves more towards Asia. Do you think that sort of national identity debate still goes on?
I think you've raised some really interesting points. Actually, part of that national identity debate in the 1990s was also based on this idea that we had to reinvent and you know, sort of almost constantly apologise for our racist past in order to engage with Asia. During the Howard government, that approach was definitely put on the back burner, and we engaged with Asia, but we didn't apologise for the kind of society we are. And that didn't just extend to talking about issues like racism. We talked about we are not going to sacrifice, you know, some of our fundamental freedoms and principles just in order to engage with societies that don't necessarily share those values in Asia. I think that debate is even more important now when we see the rise of, an assertive China under the current regime. I think it's more important than ever that we restate what our core values and non-negotiables are. We don't have to sacrifice them in order to have peaceful, harmonious, good commercial relations with other nations. And I think one of the issues we really need to focus on is that one of the reasons why migrants, and not just from China but from all countries, come here is that they come here to enjoy the strengths of our own society, not to come here to change those qualities in order for somehow they expect to fit into our frameworks. They come here because we are free, we are prosperous, and they want to share in those values. So it's important not to feel we have to constantly apologise to ourselves. And we also need to keep teaching not only new arrivals but people who are born here what those key strengths are, and make those the focus of unity. And that's really where I think identity politics plays a bad role, because it constantly sends out the message that this is a racist, sexist, homophobic, whatever you want to, whatever pejorative use, and it undermines cultural confidence, I think, across the board.
Yeah, sure. And look, one of the things I think is important as well is that we've always balanced social cohesion. You know, immigration to Australia is nothing new, and we've always had these sorts of challenges. But you look at our past, and I think we've, you know, with a few blemishes here and there, but on the whole, we've been incredibly successful at balancing that. What you say is, like, find ways for people to live together peacefully. And, you know, immigration from Asia is certainly not new, even though it's sometimes dressed up or presented as a very new trend where we have to sort of turn ourselves inside out and do away with the past.
Yeah, I think that's really important. One of the key arguments that I've made in my work is that it's an amazing transformation. You know, this was a racist country. We had a racist immigration policy. We decided to start changing that in 1948. By 20 years' time, the White Australia policy was gone. We've had a non-discriminatory immigration policy ever since, and we've managed to turn ourselves into one of the most, you know, multiracial and harmonious societies in the world. Why I think that happened was that we basically developed a set of what I call social manners, a way to treat people decently and as everyone else would expect to be treated, regardless of race. And what we basically did was extend the fair go that what we might call the old nativist or white Australia population, the fair go that they expected to get and to give each other, they managed to extend that on a colourblind basis to whoever came. And one of the key words in that sort of signal that was this idea that we are bringing in people, migrants, who are going to be new Australians. And yes, that did focus on the fact that we expect people to integrate and that their values and culture would be compatible with the Australian way of life. But it also emphasised that we were giving migrants the same rights and status and same fair go. And these are some of the key lessons and that we need to continue to promote, particularly at a time of record immigration. And that's what really worries me about identity politics, identity politics tells us that this is a racist country in which people can expect to have their rights and freedoms, migrants can expect to have their rights and freedoms violated. I don't think that reflects social reality. And the idea that we bring people in and try and politicise these issues and tell them that they're not going to get a fair go is it's a completely wrong way to go about it. We should be telling everyone that we can take migrants and we can successfully integrate them because the default and the standard that we expect is that we give everyone a fair go. I think that's a far more positive message for a country like Australia that wants to run a big immigration program.
Sure. And one of the points you just made before, Jeremy, is about sending that message, and I think that's really important, not just to new immigrants or new arrivals, but also the existing Australians and in our education system. But one of the incubators, and you probably know this all too well, of identity politics is universities. And I remember you recently interviewed John Howard, which was a great session, but who many millennials I know have a huge respect for him, almost a nostalgia. And despite having that enthusiasm that many millennials in my generation have for socialism, as your recent polling showed. But it was mentioned a question that protesters and that the people who we say are identity obsessors are actually just fringe dwellers and that we shouldn't take them too seriously. That I guess in that sort of saying that, yeah, that we shouldn't be too worried about these people. What's your response to something like that? And should we really be worried about these things?
Sure. Look, well, that question was actually asked by the Chancellor of Sydney University, who happened to be in the audience. And look, my response to that is to say two things. One is that we should look at the Sydney University's marketing campaign they released last year, which was called Unlearn, and it was basically mainstreaming these postmodern ideas about how, you know, the purpose of the university was to, you know, challenge established norms, and was, you know, basically promoting the whole identity politics view of the world. The other thing that we've also had the recent controversy over the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization. They want to set up a degree in Western Civilization at one of the sandstone universities. They were negotiating are still negotiating with Sydney Uni. And we had more than 100 academics at Sydney Uni write a letter complaining about how Western civilization was exclusory, and you know, and it would it had oppressed all of these minorities throughout history. They're pretty good signs that it's not just a minority. There's a lot of evidence that humanities departments across universities, predominantly teach identity politics. That was one of the findings of the IPA research that was released last year, you know, that all of these courses, most history courses in Australian universities teach identity politics, don't teach the traditional way of teaching history. We also recently had Claire Lehman, who's the founder of Colette, which is an online platform that deals with a lot of these issues around universities. And when I put this question to her, we had a conversation here at the CIS last week, and her point was that, look, you can say it might only be a minority, but they're a very influential minority, and particularly in the humanities, because the powers that be, all the professors and associate professors, are all these sort of identity politics people who teach their courses in this way. And what they've basically, the positions they now hold mean they are very influential, and that means they have, you know, power of veto over who gets appointed, what sort of research is done by postgraduate students. So they are not just a fringe dwelling minority, they are a very powerful and influential and more importantly, politicized group who will fight to maintain what they see as the correct way to teach all these disciplines, which is basically through the lens of identity politics.
Yeah, sure. And so I think it's just obviously not a good barometer or a good gauge to just assess the number of people who show up to protest, that you've got to look at, like you say, the content of the courses, the research being done, and then the persuasions of the faculty members and what sort of shaping they're doing for the younger generation.
Look, and the other way to look at this is that, you know, there is a genuine hostility towards, well, you could say conservatives, but you could also just say traditionalists, that, you know, basically I wouldn't be given the time of day in any of those, in a sandstone or probably any other history department in Australia, because I don't just want to run the left progressive line that this is a racist country, and, you know, that means we need laws like 18C to keep us civilised. If I was to run, that just wouldn't be acceptable within these departments. So rather than saying, look, the real hardcore might be a small minority, but they are active, you pay a price socially and professionally if you dissent from the, you know, left progressive consensus on these issues. So it's really the monoculture and, moreover, the lack of academic freedom that exists within the universities that is a real concern. And it's an issue that, you know, chancellors and vice-chancellors should take seriously, because Australian universities currently receive about $17 billion of funding a year from taxpayers. They are community institutions, and they should reflect the pluralism of the people who actually fund them, which is taxpayers. They shouldn't just be a stack for a particular political worldview, which is what they are, unfortunately, at the present time.
Yeah, sure. And I think as well, if you just look at the sharper ends of identity politics and, I guess, with the application of these ideas, that it actually becomes incredibly, incredibly divisive. And I know you wrote recently about the University of Melbourne's Where We Stand dance performance. And I mean, I just remember reading that and I just literally couldn't believe that they were doing something like that. And, you know, overseas it gets much more volatile. But I noticed recently that the Washington Post and put out a piece that, or someone wrote a piece, why can't we hate white men, and 37 things people need to stop. White men need to stop doing in 2018 to ruining things. So I think you do see the application of these ideas, and even though they might be considered fringe, which I don't think they are given what we're discussing, but you put them in context or an application, they're practically very, very divisive.
Well, there's no question about that, that they are, you know, they're by definition divisive. When you tell people that the most important thing about either themselves or other people is their race or their gender or their sexuality, you're setting up a situation where, you know, what do you, you know, that, as I say, by definition is divisive. The other thing I'm concerned about is that in most things in Australia, we tend to be, you know, 10 to 20 years behind what's happening overseas. That used to be the old rule. But given the world has shrunk with communications and you know, travel and all the rest, I fear that we might be closing that 10 to 20 year gap. And so what we see on US campuses will come to Australia far more rapidly. And I think we're already seeing signs like that, like the Melbourne University theatre production that you mentioned, that we'll get this far more rapidly. So we need to start thinking now about, you know, how we manage to fight back against these ideas. And we've got to remember that when we're not just, you know, we can't just do it in a polarizing way, because that just, I think, adds to the problem. We need to focus on, you know, one thing, the fundamental principles that are at stake, like free speech, like academic freedom, but we also need to focus on the real issue, which is the quality of our society. What kind of society are we going to live in if we constantly talk only about the things that divide us, not about the things that unite us? And one of those things that has to unite us is that we need to respect the rights of all groups, but also respect the fact that we're not going to agree about everything, and we need to respect the fact that people have the right to dissent and say things that other people might even find offensive in a free and democratic society. We all need to be adults about these issues and not expect to just have our view of the world enforced.
Sure, and I think universities, especially that place where those things should happen. And like we've been discussing, Jeremy, what I wrote about recently is that identity politics camouflages some of the best instances from our past. And I think we've got some great role models to draw from who endured real and not imagined discrimination from our past and really broke that perpetual victim narrative, and I'm thinking of figures like Neville Bonner, World War I servicemen like Frederick Prentice and Douglas Grant. There's really actually countless examples of past Australians who are really great role models in that sense. Mm. Are there any figures or examples that you think from our past are important to you that actually mean something to you or that you think are just worth highlighting?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question again. I have to say though that I've sort of never really been into the sort of great men or great women, dare I say, or view of history. I've never really individualised it very much, but I guess what I am, if I was to describe the sort of a broad school that I belong to as a, speaking as a historian, is that I'm really a nationalist historian, in not in the pejorative or chauvinistic sense, but in the sense that, like most nationalists, I believe that Australian society has some very good and very distinctive qualities that set it apart. And one of those, and part of the reason why I'm particularly interested in these issues of racism and immigration and how we've managed to create a, you know, a harmonious and multiracial society, is that it comes from my background. Come from a migrant background, but I'm sort of half Maltese, and on the other side it's sort of old Australian on my mum's side. Yeah. And so I've sort of always been this half sort of insider outsider into the society. So I think that probably explains why I've always had this interest in Australian history and these sort of features of our society. And back to where we started, why I've always been so keen on trying to address this issue that Australia is a racist society, because I was taught that at university and I felt like the people who were teaching me it were sort of strangers in their own land, because it didn't sort of tally with mine and my own family's experience. So the people who I always try and give credit for in this story about Australia and try and tell people that, you know, we were racist, but we've managed to overcome it, is just, in a sense, ordinary people. And one of these stories actually comes from my family. My father grew up in the Depression, and he didn't have enough money to be able to go to the pictures. And in those days, the pictures was the, you know, the big social event in Australian society. But he had a friend who was a guy called Maxie Wilson, who would give him, I think it was threepence, so he could afford to go to the movies every weekend. And so I reckon that from that time, you know, my family was on the path to integration, and in a sense that is the sort of mateship and fair go attitude that I think has been the real key to Australian society. And those sort of attitudes have existed to newcomers across, you know, workplaces and schools and over the back fence, literally, in many cases. So for me, the heroes of our history are ordinary people who have managed to find ways to live together peacefully by basically treating people with decency and as they expect to treat other people. So for me, they're the people whose stories and values that I want to celebrate.
Sure. I think that's a really good way to look at it, actually, and I think there's just some great humbling examples of mateship and the fair go, like you say, and those are concepts and ideals that can actually appeal to everyone. I don't think you have to look too hard for, or young Australians, or any Australian has to look too hard for examples of those.
Yeah. I actually sort of put this thesis before at a conference a couple of years ago, and there was a very senior ranking public servant who, let's put it this way, he had an ethnic surname, and he, you know, virtually said the same thing, that it was this way, that the way that his family was integrated, because there was, you know, there was a family across the road who, you know, welcomed them and treated them well, and, you know, they've never felt alienated from Australia or Australian society as a result. And I think there are literally millions of those stories, and we should celebrate them more often. You know, we shouldn't tell people that this is a racist country. We should tell people the reasons why it is not a racist country, so that we promote those values across the board, and that those values, which I think are Australian values, become the standard and the way that we run a successful immigration program. I think that's a wonderful story, and I really wish our schools and our universities would tell that will tell that story. And moreover, myself, I wish that people like the Race Discrimination Commissioner would tell that story and not do as what the current occupant of that role has done, which is to constantly tell us the bad stories, apparently, about what a racist place we are. We need to promote the values that overcome racism, not promote the kind of identity politics which actually will entrench racial division.
Sure. I think it's quite interesting when you look at how hard that person does have to look for instances of to validate their mandate. Go ahead, Jim. Yeah.
No, what I've noticed about the way that Tim Sopomasan has run his arguments is that he says, you know, there is this dark underbelly of racism in Australian society, so therefore we need things like 18C to clamp down on hate speech. And there's a sort of presumption as if we are constantly in this, what I've called this sort of pre-fascist moment, like if suddenly the Human Rights Commission doesn't exist, we will suddenly have a repeat of, you know, Nazism. Yeah. And I just think I think that's really important because we've got these divisions between elites and ordinary people, and this view of this sort of great unwashed who are, you know, barely civilized, it does a lot of disservice to ordinary people who, as I said before, are the true heroes of this story, who have managed to make living in a multiracial society a success. A success in a way that, to go back to that that Quadrant article I wrote in 2001, in a way that the founders of the White Australia policy thought was impossible. They thought a multiracial society would inevitably be divided along racial lines, it would be politically divided, it would end in racial conflict, and we have proven them wrong. That's a great story, and that's the story we should be telling people about how and why the great society we live in today has managed to exist. It's as I say, it's the ordinary people and their values that have made it a success. It's not highfalutin human rights commissions and lawyers and Section 18C. Yep. The true heroes of this story are ordinary people.
Yeah, sure. And I think that's exactly right about what you said earlier about it's almost like this kaleidoscope of resentments that just keep continually popping up. And I just don't think if you believe that, then we're ever going to be out of the woods. We're always just going to have this thing hanging over us where we need people like human legal mechanisms and 18C and these sorts of rules to be put on society.
Well, I think what I also fear is that there will ultimately be, I fear that there will be a political backlash. And I don't mean that there will be a backlash because people either are racist or sexist. But what's happening is that people are actually being accused of holding values that they don't hold. So, you know, we need to have speech codes about, you know, gender or sexuality or about race. And the presumption is that you people need this because you are racist, bigoted, homophobic. And I think that a lot of people resent that, and that is where you fear the political blowback and the sort of, if I dare say it, the sort of Donald Trump or the Brexit phenomena. And the sort of alien, in a democratic society, it is not a good thing when the political class is alienated from the ordinary voters. I think that should go without saying. And what you will get, unless we find a way to deal with these issues that respect the rights and, you know, and the common sense of ordinary people, is that you will get more political disruption. And I don't necessarily think that is a good thing at a time when we have a whole host of economic and other social issues that we could more productively be putting our political energies into, rather than this sort of constant divisiveness around identity. I just don't think that's a good way for us to try and, you know, deal with the collective and the common political issues that we face. We should be focusing on the problems that we all face living in this society, rather than this endless, you know, individual identity politics and the accusations that go along with those.
Sure. And you're right, I think in terms of just the trends can catalyse so rapidly. You mentioned at the start of the interview Julia Gillard's misogyny speech, which went viral. I was listening to a good podcast the other day where David Bonson, who's the author of Crisis and Responsibility, made a point about the hashtag MeToo movement, which kind of just came out of nowhere, but just catalyzed just very rapidly and quickly. And I think these sorts of trends can just be really pronounced and they can go either side of politics. It doesn't just belong to the left or the progressive side of politics, but both sides too.
I think that's true. Look, I would say that I think the left has got an advantage because it does control or have far more influence through some of the key culture-shaping institutions. We've mentioned schools. You could also add universities, of course. You could add the media, particularly in Australia, with the preponderance of the ABC. But I think, ultimately, I've got a very conservative argument for why these sort of Me Toos and identity politics issues take off, which is that, at the end of the day, we all do live in a society, and we are concerned about what we think other people think about us. And so people will often stay silent, or they will jump on sort of identity politics bandwagons because they want other people to think good about them. So they sort of, you know, they do what the term literally means. They virtue signal about those things. And they do things that the culture rewards them for doing. And that's the same thing why people embrace victimology. You know, they say they embrace the victimology of identity politics because they actually get rewarded for doing it. And so we need to address all these things at that cultural level as well. And I think where the fight back on that front starts is that we need political leaders, but also other organisations, to have the bravery to speak out on these issues so that people feel they have cover and support if they too are going to speak out on these issues. And look, it's very easy for me to say. I'm in a privileged position, you know, working in a think tank, which is a values-based organisation where people literally pay money and support us to enable me to do that. But that's really one of the things that I want to do in our new Culture, Prosperity and Civil Society program. I want to try and provide that sort of leadership and give people both the confidence but also the arguments that they need in order to push back against a lot of this stuff. The other reason why this matters and you know, another sign of how far we haven't managed to push back successfully is that all of this identity politics stuff is now rife across the corporate sector, and it's even gone through all the major sporting codes where they've all jumped on this as well. So, you know, it's not too late, but we've really got to get serious about how and why we sort of fight these cultural battles, because as I said before, you know, some fundamental freedoms are at stake, but also some of the fundamental qualities of what make our society function and make our society a good society are also at stake.
Yeah, look, those are really good points. And I think that political top cover point is something that's really critical as well, I think sometimes is missed. And one of the, you know, you mentioned, you know, promoting values and pointing to our strengths. And I think, you know, cultural competence in our past is just really critically important. But just to round out, because I don't want to run over or run long, Jeremy, but one of the sort of final points is you do notice that a lot of the discussion is very superficial. You know, whenever Australia Day rolls around, there's this idea that we, you know, we'll change the date and Flag Day, I don't think many people know, is 3rd of September, but it's those same sorts of symbolic arguments that pop up. You know, these statues of Captain Cook being defaced and all those sorts of things. What's your sort of idea, or what are your thoughts around those things? Why are they so superficial, and what do you think is a good way to, I guess, in wrapping up, but just build that cultural confidence so we can avoid that sort of, I think, what is really cheap symbolism?
Yeah, well, look, I agree with you that it's cheap symbolism. But however, I'll drill down to the detail of this, because I think it's a really important question, particularly the Australia Day issue and Indigenous affairs. look, there's no question that the arrival of Europeans in Australia and, you know, what some people call British settlement and some people prefer to call British invasion, that was a tragedy for Indigenous people and Indigenous society. The question, however, is what do we do about the fact that that history is irreversible and it's now our shared fate for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to share this continent as our home. I think like most Australians, I want all Indigenous people to enjoy the same opportunities and freedoms and rights that everyone else has. But my concern about the sort of Australia Day and the defacement of statues, Captain Cook statues issue is that that is sending the message that the reason why there are some Indigenous people who are very poor and very disadvantaged in Australia stems from the original sin of invasion. And I just think that is fundamentally not true. The people with the worst outcomes, social outcomes in the Indigenous people with the worst outcomes in Australia live in those remote communities, the remote homelands. They were set up in the 1970s in order to sort of apologise or make up for invasion by allowing Indigenous people to live on the traditional lands and live close to culture. So we tried to make up for the original sin of colonisation and invasion. And that experiment, the results of that, the appalling social outcomes in those communities for themselves in terms of how that has happened, how that has ended up making it worse for a minority of Indigenous people. So I think we need to have an honest debate. This is where, rather than the symbolism actually has a substance, because that symbolism tells us that what we need to do is continue to apologise and continue to try and make up and allow Indigenous people to live close to culture. I think that has actually been disastrous. If you look at more broadly, the Indigenous people who are doing well are those who live in mainstream society and enjoy all the rights, privileges and opportunities that most other Australians do, except for the minority of Indigenous people in those communities. So I think we need to, if we want to actually have a real debate about Indigenous disadvantage, the statues and the Australia Day debates are distractions, but they are also politically destructive distractions because they send the fundamentally wrong message about what is actually needed to overcome Indigenous disadvantage. So I hope that that wasn't too convoluted an answer, but I feel that, you know, at some point we've got to recognise that it's not, Indigenous disadvantage is not due to our failure to make up for the sins of the past. It is actually a product of the way we have tried to make up for those sins, with what I would argue is disastrous results for about 75,000 Indigenous people in those communities.
No, it's not too convoluted. That was a great answer, and I'm actually glad you brought it up because it reminds me of a piece that you wrote reviewing Stan Grant's book, and I think it's called Nostalgia for Injustice. And I think you make the exact same point as you made in that review, that those forces that actually condemned Indigenous people to disadvantage previously aren't the same drivers that are what are condemning them today. And yeah, I think it's a really, really important point to make and have a, like you say, an honest and rational discussion over.
Exactly, you know, but you know, by trying to make up for the sins of the past, we've been making it worse for those Indigenous people. Look, I'm very proud of that piece that I wrote about Stan Grant's book, and I do think it has had actually an influence on Stan Grant's thinking, because he has, you know, I think in things that he's subsequently written has moved closer to my position, perhaps as a result of what I had to say. There is hope that the debate, that these debates, what I want to say is that you can have an influence on these debates if you say things well, you say them rationally, and we do what is essential in order to address these issues, which is to actually be able to discuss it without the name calling, without the identity politics offence taking. That is the true foundation of the society we have today, which is we're able to debate issues freely and fairly and then actually come to the right conclusion, because we've aired the arguments, we've sifted through the evidence, and we've let the facts dictate our conclusions. If we resort to an identity politics way of, you know, dealing with these issues, someone will say literally to me, shut up, you're a racist. We can't talk about this. If we can't talk about that, how can we end up finding out what the right answer is? So to me, this is a practical demonstration of where particularly laws like 18C, the way that they were used to try and shut down Bill Leake and the debate about Indigenous child protection, that's a really good example of where by employing identity politics and all the apparatus and censorship that goes with that, we can actually produce terrible outcomes for those who these debates are supposedly meant to be helping.
Sure. That's a really good point about having an honest debate, but just being constructive and rational. And it was actually I didn't realise that there was some influence there with Stan Grant's position and his writing, which is actually quite a good thing to hear about why we need to have those discussions. And I can recall on that panel you did with John Howard recently, he just mentioned that it was really important to also just maintain that sense of decorum when we have these discussions, which I think is a really, really good point. And I think a conversation like this is just a really good place to continue that discussion. And look, Jeremy, I really thank you for coming on the Jacobs podcast. It's been a tremendous interview, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about identity politics today.
My pleasure, Sean. Really enjoyed the chat.
Thank you, listeners. I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Dr. Jeremy Sammet. A reminder, on whatever platform you listen to the Jacobs podcast on, whether it's Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, please rate or leave a message. And if you want to get in touch with me to discuss future topics or any ideas that you have, please get in touch at seanjacobs.com.au. Thank you.